All right. Well, the national question has always been a difficult issue for Marxists to grapple with. And unlike some other aspects of capitalism, national oppression and national identity is very specific to each country and to the particular peoples that comprise it. As well as being very particular, depending on context, nationalism contradicts a fundamental principle of Marxism, which is the international unity of the working class against their capitalist oppressors. As Marx and Engels famously said in the Communist Manifesto, the workers have no country. While fundamentally correct, this maxim can only take Marxists so far. The history of capitalism, even in Marx's time, was filled with examples of national questions which played out in both progressive and democratic directions, as well as reactionary and authoritarian ways. And so understanding Lenin's contributions on the national question is very much about how Marxists after Marx tried to reconcile the aspirations of oppressed people for national rights and the international revolutionary struggle of the working class to overthrow capitalism. Lenin's approach was the most sophisticated as well as most principled of the approaches developed during the period of incipient world revolution that followed the Russian Revolution and World War I. And given it was in such an important period, and I think that's what helps to explain why it was still such an important approach for us to examine today, even though the world has changed significantly since then. So the way I'm going to approach this very complex topic is to outline the political positions held by Marxists leading up to the 1917 Russian Revolution, because they were all informed and, you know, Lenin's position was informed through a debate with each of those, and assess those positions. And then I'll go over how Lenin's politics were applied in practice following the workers' revolution in Russia, both in the Soviet Republic itself, as well as in the cause of the international revolution. So Lenin's politics on the national question were developed in contest, as I said, with the currents in the Russian Empire at the start of the... Sorry, I'm going to press this button. Nope. There. The currents in the Russian Empire at the start of the 20th century. So it is useful to examine the politics on the national question within Russian social democracy. So... yeah, before I get to that, though, I think it's also important to understand the context in the Russian Empire. So Russia was at the time was what Lenin called the prison house of nations. The Russian people were actually a minority concentrated in the territory of European Russia centered around Moscow, and they constituted only 42% of the population. The remaining 58% of the entire population of the empire were subject nationalities. So you can see on this map, the pink in the middle, basically, of that map, and this is just European Russia, is actually great Russian people. But of the national minorities in Russia, there was pretty diverse experience. The nomads of Central Asia experienced settler colonialism at the hands of Russian settlers who dispossessed of their lands for farming. Jewish people were restricted by law to live in overcrowded slums. They had great difficulty in finding employment. They're also subjected to intense scapegoating by authorities and periodically targeted for pogroms. People don't know what pogroms are. They were racist massacres which took the lives of tens of thousands of Jewish people from 1881 until the destruction of the white armies in the Russian Civil War. On the less horrific side were the Finns, who possessed their own autonomous government. So one commonality across the entire empire, however, was the supremacy of the Russian language, which was the forced language of instruction at all schools and also the language of government. This formed a part of a policy of Russification pursued by the Tsars since the late 19th century in order to strengthen Russian domination over the empire. With this context, I think it becomes apparent just how central the national question was for Russia's socialists. So in the Russian socialist movement, three conflicting perspectives existed in respect of the national question. Besides the Bolsheviks, which is Lenin's perspective, the Polish Social Democrats and the Jewish Bund, argued different strategies. These three positions remain the primary contending arguments among socialists in the empire. So now I'm going to go through them. The first up, we have the Bund. So they took a stand on the platform of national cultural autonomy, and I'm just going to shorten it to NCA to make it easier to say. While associated with the Austrian Social Democrats, the Bund were arguably the greatest champions of NCA. NCA was based on the idea that nations were more or less permanent, and based on a shared language and history. The concept sought to categorize all peoples within a state based on their nationality, and that the state would guarantee rights based on that nationality. This categorization would operate on an individual basis for each person in the state and not on a territorial basis. So it's been termed, it's also been termed extraterritorial autonomy. For the advocates of NCA, It was an attempt to resolve the problem of nationally heterogeneous states, such as the Austro-Hungarian Empire. For the Bund, it seemed to resolve the issue of the dispersal of Jewish people across the Russian Empire, because they weren't really like concentrated in one particular area. Thus, the Bund resolved their 1901 Congress that Russia must in future be transformed into a federation of nationalities with full autonomy for each, regardless of the territory it inhabits. The Bund also generalized out from this position that the Russian Social Democratic Party should also operate as a federation of nationalities. While initially not just the domain of the, just the domain of the Bund, NCA became more generally widespread among other national minority parties, as well as the Socialist Revolutionaries, and from 1912, the Mensheviks as well. So the second perspective was an internationalist opposition to national self-determination. And I think that even though people here might be like, oh, against self-determination, they must have been terrible. Well, these people were, unlike most of the NCA advocates, were genuine revolutionaries who sought to subordinate the national struggle to proletarian revolution. So the most famous partisans of this perspective were, famous revolutionaries, particularly the Polish socialists, Rosa Luxemburg, Leo Jogiczys, and Karl Radek. It was also the view of the sizable Latvian social democracy, and it was a broader sentiment among socialists from many of the national minorities after the October Revolution, and it was also held to by a minority of Bolsheviks. So you can see on the screen there, for instance, Pyatakov and Bukharin. The starting point of this opposition to self-determination was internationalism, an attempt to apply, as we've said, the concept of international solidarity. Luxemburg dedicated much of her theoretical work to proving developments within capitalism showed that national self-determination was utopian and reactionary and superfluous under socialism, comparable to the demand for a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. She argued that the economic integration of Russian-controlled Poland links the future development of that territory to Russia. The tendency of development towards bigger and bigger states was made impossible independence of small states like Poland. And the only group she said that supported nationalism were intellectuals and the backwards looking nobility. And to what extent workers actually supported national independence, united the workers with these backwards layers and also obscured their opposition to the capitalists. So what this meant practically for the Polish party was that they firstly correctly advocated that the Polish workers would only win socialism through a joint struggle with the Russian workers. But their position was not just hostility to Polish nationalism, but actually active opposition to Polish independence. And this is actually very important because another workers' party of similar size to the Polish Social Democrats, Polish Socialist Party, did advocate independence. So this actually meant that the question of independence became an obstacle to united working class struggle. So that's precisely the situation which their advocacy of internationalism was supposed to overcome. So actually, yeah, very very counterproductive. So Lenin and the majority Bolshevik position on the national question represented, I think, a third pole sort of between these two positions. The Bolsheviks advocated for the right to national self-determination as being, to quote Lenin, the logical expression of the struggle against national oppression in every form. The opposition which the Bolsheviks displayed to national oppression was about fighting for the closest unity of the working class of the Russian Empire in all its diversity. They argued that only such a movement which fought against all manifestations of national privilege and oppression could forge that kind of unity required to overthrow this multi-ethnic and multinational empire, since the majority of the population were from the oppressed nationalities. The struggle for a democratic republic in Russia and later the socialist revolution was inseparable from the struggle for democratic rights of which national self-determination was part. So the advocacy of the right of self-determination did not just mean that Lenin was an advocate of independent states. Lenin said that it was comparable to the right of divorce. Doesn't mean you say you're for divorce, just means that you're for the right for independence. So in general, Lenin was actually for the closest unity of states as a method of uniting workers and developing the productive forces, but he argued that this had to be a free association or else it would endanger the revolution's success as well as its own democratic goals. So the guiding principle, I would argue, from 1903 behind Lenin and the Bolsheviks' advocacy of this point, the right of nations to self-determination, which was part of their program, was how the proletariat could lead a revolutionary struggle against Tsarism, uniting behind it all the groups that were oppressed by the Tsarist state. So to give people a better sense of how Lenin applied this last position, I'm going to go through some detail about how he sort of countered the arguments of the NCA advocates as well as the Luxembourgists. So Lenin, I think, had a much more dynamic understanding of the development of nationalist consciousness and national movements than either the Luxembourgists or NCA advocates. While the Luxembourgists observed the tendency of capitalism to overcome national divisions, and thus they basically said it's irrelevant as a question, the NCA advocates witnessed the opposite tendency, which was for national identities to be strengthened, and argued that socialists should also advocate for this further development. Lenin basically said both of these tendencies actually do exist under capitalism in contradiction with each other. So this is a direct quote, I think it's quite good. The first of those tendencies is the awakening of national life and national movements, the struggle against all national oppression and the creation of national states. The second is the development and growing frequency of international intercourse in every form, the breakdown of national barriers, the creation of the international unit of capital, of economic life in general, of politics, science, etc. So this meant that first and foremost, the presentation of the national question was a political question, not reducible to economics. Lenin was actually open to different routes that history might take. The emphasis which Lenin takes on the question of self-determination was not based on some sort of preconceived assessment of what constituted a nation, which is often how the NCA advocates, as well as like the Luxembourgists, would try and argue to dismiss or support national claims, usually with reference to things like culture, language, or economics. Instead, Lenin was guided by the idea of democratic rights, which the workers' struggle for revolution could take to their most radical conclusion. So Lenin said, it would be a fundamental mistake to suppose that the struggle for democracy can divert the proletariat from the socialist revolution, which was the argument of the Luxembourgists, or obscure or overshadow it, etc. On the contrary, just as socialism cannot be victorious unless it introduces complete democracy, so the proletariat will be unable to prepare for victory over the bourgeoisie unless it wages a many-sided, consistent, and revolutionary struggle for democracy. So one of the arguments that Luxembourgists made was that independence under capitalism is basically totally ephemeral and meaningless, because international finance capital means that, you know, we're all basically part of the international capitalist system. But Lenin said this fact that we are all part of an international capitalist system, which significantly reduces real democracy and independence, does not in the least destroy the significance of political democracy. And I think he compared it to how all forms of democracy under capitalism are incomplete and exist in a mutilated form and as a rare exception, but this does not mean that they do not exist and that socialists should dismiss different forms of democracy or the struggle for democratic rights. So Lenin also distinguished very sharply between who was making Luxembourgist arguments against self-determination. It was much more harsh if it was people who were from an oppressor nation as against people who were from, you know, the Poles, an oppressed group within the Russian Empire. But his main argument in both cases was great Russian nationalism, which is the nationalism of the oppressor nation, was the most important and most significant nationalism in Russia. This is what had to be opposed. And thus it was a question for all socialists in Russia to advocate the right to self-determination. So in terms of the national cultural autonomy question, though, Lenin rejected that because he opposed the idea that socialists should champion one's own national culture in opposition to working class internationalism. And that's important because this was specifically arguing against, you know, oppressed groups within the Russian Empire. Even a nationally oppressed group, it should not be the business of socialists to actively advocate such a culture, which he argued could only be the culture of the ruling class of that oppressed group. Even amongst Jews who were horrifically oppressed, they had their own bourgeoisie who would rather perpetuate the social isolation and oppression of the Jews than see the workers rise. So Lenin was particularly hostile to the idea, which was advocated by NCA people, the children would be obliged to attend different schools based upon their heritage. He opposed this from the point of view of democracy in general and also from the interests of the proletarian class struggle. He drew comparisons to the situation for Black people in the United States, which is basically still a segregated situation right now, despite formal equality, but was definitely much more segregated when Lenin was writing. And he pointed out that actually the advocacy of separate schools for Jewish children was actually supported by the far right. His perspective on the question of federation within the Socialist Party was similar. He argued that making the Russian Social Democratic Party into a federation was calling for each party to retreat into their own comfortable corner. The unity of the proletariat was absolutely essential, both the achievement of the ultimate aim and in the interest of an unswerving political and economic struggle in the conditions of the existing society. And it's important to say that Lenin was not calling for, which is often sort of this argument that's made against Lenin, he wasn't just calling for the Bund and Jewish workers to abandon their own struggle against oppression. He said, rather, complete unity of the Jewish and non-Jewish proletariat is particularly necessary for a successful struggle against anti-Semitism. And he argued that a united organization should in no way restrict the independence of our Jewish comrades in conducting propaganda or agitation in one language or another, in publishing literature adapted to the needs of their situation, or in advancing such slogans as are necessary. But the Workers' Party had to be unified across all divisions of race, sex, or occupation, and struggles against oppression had to be genuine collective struggles of the entire working class. So Lenin was actually arguing for all workers to have to be concerned and to fight against the oppression of Jewish people in Russia. So NCA, I think, was actually based on an accommodation to the divisions that capitalism perpetuates. Basically, it was an effort to alleviate national friction. And that's why I think it was increasingly taken up by class collaborationists in the Russian Empire, particularly the Mensheviks. And you can see how this is different from Lenin's starting point, which was basically about how can we most get rid of national oppression altogether and create the best conditions for democracy, to what extent it can exist under capitalism and then increasingly under socialism. So that outline of the different political positions in the socialist movement, hopefully that's helpful. I want to spend the rest of this talk looking at the evolution of those politics, how they then played out following 1917. So most accounts of the revolution rightly emphasize what's going on in Moscow and Petrograd, but no less significant to the preservation of the revolution in the industrial center of Russia was the spread of the revolution to the majority of people which lived in the oppressed nations of the empire. And then, of course, further afield to become a genuine international struggle. So in this respect, we need to understand the policies of both the new revolutionary government, which is led by the Bolsheviks, as well as the revolution and civil war and how that played out across the empire. So only a week following the insurrection, so it's an indication of the priorities, the Council of People's Commissars, led by Lenin, passed a Declaration of the Rights of the People of Russia, which outlined the equality and sovereignty of peoples of Russia, the right of the peoples of Russia to free self-determination, even to the point of separation and the formation of an independent state, the abolition of any and all national and national religious privileges and disabilities, and the free development of national minorities and ethnographic groups inhabiting the territory of Russia. The new government also set up a Commissariat of Nationalities, which was called Narkomnats, which was headed up by Stalin. Narkomnats had a responsibility for the governance of the variegated national minorities inherited from the empire and of building up Soviet power among them. Stalin applied this principle of self-determination to the winning of the oppressed nationalities to Soviet power, arguing for national territorial autonomy. I just think I should just pause to say, obviously, we are definitely not Stalinists in this organization. Stalin was basically at this time pretty much following what Lenin was for in terms of the Bolshevik majority position at this time. So, yeah, Stalin applied the principle of self-determination to the winning of the oppressed nationalities to Soviet power. As I said, he argued for national territorial autonomy. It would be impossible for the oppressed nationalities, he argued, to be won to Soviet power unless these regions are autonomous. That is, they have their own schools, courts, administrations, organs of power, and social, political, and cultural institutions. Unless the laboring masses of these regions are fully guaranteed the right to use their own language in all spheres of social and political activity. So these perspectives reflected an application of the concepts the Bolsheviks had outlined in the original program of Russian social democracy. That it included not just the right for self-determination, but also the right to one's own language and educational and state institutions, as well as regional autonomy. So in order to overcome the historical oppression and backwardness inflicted on these regions by Tsarism, previously oppressed areas needed the capability to build up their own autonomous institutions. So it's there's basically, a lot you could say about how they implemented this approach. But I can only really draw out the general perspectives because otherwise I'd have to do another talk. So basically the main dynamic post-revolution was the central Soviet government led by Lenin in Moscow and helped by the perspectives worked out by Narkomnats, which was primarily comprised of oppressed nationality communists. They were generally the champion of self-determination and they generally found themselves pitched against the perspectives of local communists operating in the territories oppressed by Tsarism. So in general, the local parties held to ultra-left positions, which saw the national question as irrelevant or utopian. So basically they were Luxembourgists, which usually went hand in hand with hostility towards the peasantry, dividing up the land in favor of forcible collectivization. This is an important phenomenon to recognize, I think. It was because, yeah, both in the context of parties made up of oppressed nationalities. So as I mentioned before, Latvians and Poles being one of those cases, but also where parties were largely comprised of Russified workers operating in a colonial context, like in the Ukraine or Turkestan. The land question and the national question tended to go together. So Luxembourg opposed the Bolsheviks on both the issue of opposing national self-determination and opposing the land, the peasants getting land. And I think both of those positions follow the same reasoning. The democratic demands of the oppressed were counterposed to the social liberation of the workers, which was said to require collectivized land and big unified states. So obviously no Marxist, I think, at the time or since would disagree that in the future, socialist society, there will be no borders, and that large-scale industry and agriculture, and of course more widely, is a necessary component for the abolition of scarcity. But the crucial failure of the Luxembourgist position was that unless the workers could convince the majority of the oppressed in society that their interests lay in a workers' revolution, then the workers weren't going to get to power, and their revolution would end in a tragic defeat, which is what happened, unfortunately. So to really appreciate the significance of this question after the 1917 revolution, we need to look at some of how was it applied. So in the German-occupied territories of the Ukraine, Baltic states, and Poland, they were actually like the front line of the international revolution after the revolution in Germany in November 1918. So there was actually this huge revolutionary tumult across this huge territory, which saw the Red Army advance essentially nearly to the borders of Germany. Soviet republics were established in Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, and the Ukraine. The revolution was nearly able to establish a bridgehead into the center of Europe with the formation of the Hungarian Soviet Republic in March 1919, which is depicted on the map, but not circled in red for some reason, my mistake. However, in all these cases, the local parties implemented ultra-left policies, despite the perspectives outlined by Lenin and the Soviet government. So these ultra-left policies, like collectivizing of land, raised up peasant revolts. They assisted the bourgeois nationalists because they opposed self-determination. And subsequently, they were forced into greater and greater repression as they were. They quickly became unpopular. The results were obviously disastrous. So all of those highlighted states, Soviet power fell by the end of 1919. And the failure of the revolution to spread at this stage was just as significant, I think, for the eventual isolation of the revolution in Russia as the crushing of the workers' struggle in Germany around the same time. Obviously, the revolution ultimately had to succeed in Germany, but I think the failure of the revolution to spread in Eastern Europe was a crucial sort of factor in that failure. While ultra-left policies led to the defeat of workers' revolution in the Baltic states and Poland, after many false starts and terrible mistakes, the central Bolshevik leadership was actually able to push for more sensible approaches in the Ukraine and also in Central Asia and Turkestan to include the largely non-Russian peasantry and also local nationalists in the Soviets. Both these territories would later become models of the indigenization policy pursued by the Soviets to overcome the legacy of Russification. So just briefly mentioning Turkestan, it was the first autonomous republic established by the Soviets on the 30th of April 1918, but it was followed by a blossoming of similar republics. And that's important because, you know, if Lenin was just an authoritarian out to reestablish the Russian Empire, why on earth would they go around establishing autonomous republics very proactively? So between 1918 and 1923, there were actually 13 autonomous republics established as part of the RSFR. And they're based on a combination mostly of like either local initiatives with very little resistance from the central government, or no resistance at all, basically, but also the central government itself actually saying, we think this is an important question, regardless of what you local Russian workers think, and we think it's important that there's an autonomous area. The reversal of the policy of Russification in favor of indigenization meant establishing education based on native language, but also an effort to elevate the status of the oppressed nations and to find national communist cadres. So the fruit of these policies, I think, is well seen in surveys that were conducted 10 years after the revolution, 1927, but that's actually before like peak Stalinist reaction sets in. But in that year, most Communist Party leaderships at a local level in Central Asia, the Caucasus, the Ukraine, and Belarusia were from their respective nationality rather than Russian. In those same states, 88% of children were being taught in their native language, and actually most of the other 12% were learning two languages. So the establishment of native language education and the Bolsheviks' orientation to raising the cultural level of nationalities previously oppressed by Tsarism is, I think, one of the most important reasons why literacy increased massively during the period of the Bolsheviks. So 28% in 1897, which was the only time the Tsarists bothered to ask. It was, and by 1926, it was 56.6%. So just like the best example, I think, is in Central Asia. At the same time, literacy improved from 2.5% to 15%. So the Civil War period is usually depicted as one in which Lenin and the Bolsheviks abandoned the principle of national self-determination, having demagogically called for it prior to the ascension to power. So the most foremost advocate of that view is a fellow called Richard Pipes. According to Pipes, Lenin overthrew all the newly formed national republics. And he goes through a bunch of different examples, which he argues were all a complete violation of the principle of self-determination. So I think hopefully this brief overview, very, very brief, shows you that it's a bit of a reductionist view. The situation of all these states and territories was not a purely national movement versus Russian communist imperialism. The situation across the territories of the old Russian Empire was one of civil war between workers and reactionary landlords and capitalists. The challenge for these different Soviet governments that were established in all those territories was how to secure support among the vast peasant majority of those societies through a thoroughgoing program of land reform. And that challenge was made harder in those cases where the working class was isolated from the peasantry by their nationality, which was definitely a problem in the Ukraine and Turkestan. But where a clear majority of workers favored independence, as in Finland, there was basically no problem getting that. Like the Bolsheviks basically, like days after revolution, give Finland independence. Bolshevik support for independence led to the establishment of independent states all over the old territory of the Russian Empire. And that's important to say as well, because, you know, this argument that they opposed independence, well, so many states were actually established that weren't even Soviet republics out of the Civil War. So the national question was presented as a central question of international revolution, not just in the Civil War, but also during the establishment of the Comintern or Communist International. So from 1920 in particular, which is sort of like the first real Congress of the Comintern, the issue of self-determination, particularly applied to colonial countries, became really important or was recognized as central. It's important to note that the theses on the colonial and national question that were adopted by the Comintern in 1920 which were also drafted by Dutch communist Henk Snijbluit, who was active in Indonesia, as well as the Indian communist M.N. Roy. And they basically situated the question of national self-determination in the context of international revolution and subordinated it to that goal. The Comintern emphasized that each country has a very historical and very concrete situation, whether they were imperialist capitalist countries, whether they were a semi-colonial country, or whether they were an outright colonized country. Approaching the national question from an exact evaluation of the historically given and above all economic milieu was the first task for communists. Secondly, all communists, even in the colonial countries, had to emphasize the explicit separation of the interests of the oppressed classes, of the toilers, of the exploited, from the general concept of the national interests, which means the interests of the ruling class. So that's important because Stalinists today definitely reverse the order and say, oh no, it's true Leninism to say that the main division is between the oppressor and oppressed nations. It was actually only after arguing that the first duty of communists was to emphasize class struggle that Lenin outlined the inequality between the oppressor and oppressed nations. So Lenin's thesis famously argued that while communists in colonial countries should ally themselves with national revolutionary movements, they should also wage a determined fight against the attempt to put a communist cloak around revolutionary liberation movements that are not really communist in the backwards countries. The Comintern could ally itself with anti-imperialist movements, but should always maintain the independence of the proletarian movement, be it only in embryo. For communist and imperialist states that oppressed other countries, their duty was to actively support in words and deeds the revolutionary struggle of the oppressed nations. Only by communists in the oppressor countries fighting against colonial oppression would the internationalism of the working class really be demonstrated, or conversely, for the communists within oppressed countries, only by insisting on international proletarian struggle and, at the time, an alliance with the Soviet Republic, could national liberation be in any way genuine? So the Comintern theses of 1920, I think, showed a continued evolution of the Bolsheviks' pre-1917 attitude to the national question. A more or less abstract insistence on the right of self-determination for oppressed nations was basically had made way for a clear appreciation of the international studies of communists in both oppressed and oppressor nations and the relationship of the issue with the international proletarian revolution. So it's just worth mentioning that this legacy was basically totally trashed by Stalin, and a gigantic shadow cast itself over all these early achievements of the Russian Revolution and the Comintern. Very, very quickly in Russia, where an all-powerful centralized bureaucracy, controlled the economy and not democratically elected workers' councils, the right of Soviet states to independence, which was part of the constitution of the USSR, for instance, was basically irrelevant. Lenin made a defense of the Georgians against Stalin's great Russian abuses. So by 1923, Stalin is very much not an advocate of the rights of the national minorities. Lenin made a fight against that one of his main struggles before he died. And he saw this as indicative of the degeneration of the revolution. But that degeneration could only have been reversed by revolution spreading to the developed European countries, which was not to be. So I've got some statistics on the screen there about what happens under Stalin. Not many people are aware that the Great Terror was also an element of it directed against national minorities explicitly, as well as that indigenization was abandoned in favor of Russification, and essentially the Soviet Union becomes a new Russian empire. And the Comintern abandons the principled idea of like working class independence in the international struggle and instead forges alliance with bourgeois nationalists like in most disastrously in China. So what can we learn from Lenin and his approach to the national question today? The national question today, I think, is still very much relevant, even if it's markedly different from the forms it assumed 100 years ago. Not only does it emerge as a question of nationally oppressed groups, and there's actually still quite a few of them in the world today, West Papua, Palestine, Kurdistan, and many others, but also it's a question of self-determination for nations that are relatively well off in their respective states like Catalonia and Scotland. The virtue of Lenin's approach was his ability to connect democratic struggles against oppression to the cause of workers' revolution. This was reflected in the perspective, and it's on the screen there, that the Revolutionary Party must be able to react to every manifestation of tyranny and oppression, no matter where it appears, no matter what stratum or class of the people it affects. Seeing national rights as a question of democracy can still, I think, be orienting for socialists today. When nationalism is used to buttress racial privileges, war and restrictive borders, i.e. when it is the nationalism of the oppressor, then of course it is the duty of socialists to combat it. When nationalism expresses itself as the demands of the oppressed or as a democratic demand, I think socialists should support that right. At the same time, it is also still relevant today for socialists not to uncritically champion national struggles as identical to the struggles of the workers, even among the nationally oppressed people. The key thing for socialists is always to show solidarity with the struggles of the workers and to build up their capacity for self-activity. So in all of these respects, Lenin's politics on the national question still pretty pressing for socialists today, just as they were 100 years ago, when the failure to adequately grapple with the issues among many revolutionaries contributed significantly to the defeat of the Eastern European Revolution and the isolation of the Russian Revolution.